Hi, this is Myra Gurney. Welcome to the Principles of Professional Communication 1 lecture on graphics and visual communication. We've spent a considerable amount of time in this course examining and discussing the impact of language on communication and the creation of meaning. The focus here has been on that form of communication which we as a culture still perceive to be of primary importance, hence the status that is attached to being able to use written language effectively. However, in terms of our perceptual processes, we have seen how the visual in our culture is also assigned a high degree of significance. Nonverbal signals and codes have a greater impact than words alone. We're immersed in a culture which places much emphasis on appearance, whether it be personal appearance or whether it's articulated by the adage that seeing is believing. Because our communication is so strongly influenced, perhaps even dominated by our social and cultural practices, we rely heavily on visual codes to reinforce messages, especially in our time-poor world. Certain icons are universal. So if we have a look at the familiar icons, some of the familiar icons and symbols on slide 2, you can see the ones that we know and we're familiar with. And they act to shortcut the act of understanding, especially across languages and cultures. Advertising images are always heavily laden with visual imagery, all aimed at getting a message across as quickly and as succinctly as possible. Companies and organisations spend much money designing and sometimes even defending corporate logos, designs or even colour schemes because they have been successful in relating these signs to their corporate ethos and to their products, and in turn having consumers make the mental link between the size, the colour, the logo, etc., and the mental image of the product. In our discussion of perception, one of the readings argued that the increasing reliance on visual media, such as television and the internet, was having a significant impact on our ability to engage with written text. We need to keep in mind from a communication perspective that reading itself requires the use of visual codes. So letters, words, space, punctuation marks. And that we also read and derive meaning from other texts such as signs, architectural designs, dress codes, furniture layout, and so on. The aim of this lecture, therefore, is to discuss some of the specifics of the use of graphical devices as they relate to report writing and to presentations, but also to explain how and why we should consider a variety of media when we are communicating. So therefore, why is the study of visual communication so important? Okay, I mentioned that our culture places much emphasis on the visual, so the old adage, seeing is believing. Visual communication in a perceptual, from a perceptual perspective is more easily processed. Graphics and visuals add another layer of meaning. And the important thing about visuals in conjunction with written text is that they actively involve engage the brain in interpretation. And as consumer behaviour theorists would argue, the act of the brain being engaged means it's more likely that readers will remember the information. It's more likely to be committed to short-term memory. So why does this work? Pictorial illustration and nonverbal signs enhance communication, as I said, by strengthening the visual channel. When used in conjunction with written or spoken language, research has shown that the message has a higher likelihood of being understood and remembered. Graphical devices attract the eye, which is a much more highly tuned sense for human beings than the ear, break the monotony of text, and very often, especially in things like cartoons, make a point emphatically and demonstrate a theme succinctly and, in some cases, humorously. Humour, even related to a serious subject like war or workplace safety, can be psychologically more emphatic than pages of words or explanations. Hence the importance of diagrams and illustrations in how-to manuals, instruction manuals. An illustration can provide a detailed description of some thing or some process or some concept, etc., without detailed, time-consuming prose. And because visual stimuli such as tables and graphs actively engage the brain, as I said, they are very effective ways of communicating, as this active engagement stimulates memory retention, etc. Research in the area of cognitive psychology indicates that illustrations may motivate readers to attend to the text and may facilitate learning as well as memory. The impact, however, will vary according to the quality of the pictures and their relevance to the topic, and is usually more effective with poor readers than with good readers. When we discussed perception, I showed you examples of visual illusions which illustrated the ways in which the eye and the brain could be deceived into thinking that something looked different compared to the way we knew it should look. There are various perceptual principles that are important to be aware of when designing visuals for reports or presentations, or even when considering the layout of reports and other documents. Okay, so what are some of these visual elements of visual literacy? Okay, now what graphic principles do, as the slide five says, is that they highlight the relationships between elements of the text, i.e. paragraphs, sections, etc., between the text and images, and between different representations of data. Now, some of these principles include the size, the colour, the proximity, i.e. whereabouts on the page it is, and where it is, where those things are in relation to each other, and the arrangement. Now, while there's a lot more to be said about these variables, some of the principles are as follows. Okay, they also include the context, the repetition, the contrast, and the alignment. Okay, now let's have a look at some of these principles in detail. Okay, so the first one is proximity. Okay, so if you group related items together, i.e. they're physically close to one another, the effect is to enhance their cohesion, enhance the perception of cohesion, i.e. that they belong together, and to give the reader a clear idea of the organisation and the content. So, for example, if you look at the illustration from top to bottom, okay, you will see that the middle one as being 13 rather than B. If you look from left to right, you see it as being B rather than 13. Now, white space, the notion of white space works by visually aligning these various elements, by giving the reader a hint, if you like, a cue, that those things don't belong together, or they do belong together. Some of the rules of thumb is that you don't put too much space between headings and the information that they introduce, otherwise the perception is that the heading doesn't go with that text. And essentially, unrelated items should be moved further away and grouped by some other unifying device, such as a colour or a box, a colour of a type or a box or a circle or some other device. Okay. Now, the principle of alignment basically states that nothing should be placed on a page or a screen arbitrarily. Every item should be visually connected to something else on the page. While proximity shows the relationship of parts to another, alignment shows that how all the parts contribute to the whole. Centered alignments are relatively sedate. Flush left or right, strengthen the overall sense of design. Okay, because it looks like there is some kind of a symmetrical theme. Once everything is aligned, you can break the rule somehow or other. But where the majority are aligned, the other merely adds a bit of visual difference, a bit of stimulation, if you like. All right. So visuals bleeding through their frame. Okay. Repetition again acts to enhance the feeling of symmetry and the feeling of whole. The feeling that there is a theme here, and that these things, we perceive them as being related. So if you have some particular element of a design, so such as, you know, a particular font, a particular size, a bold font, a line, a bullet, etc., repeat that element throughout the text. The repetition of headings and boldface types again gives readers a sense of internal consistency, and the repetition of design elements between related pieces, so for example, a particular colour, etc., supports a corporate identity. So if you use a particular colour or a particular design with one particular piece, it should be continued with the other. All right, the next one is contrast. Now, contrast, as I have there, adds excitement. It forces the reader to pay attention and indicates hierarchies and opposition. So if you have things that are opposite to each other, it's probably better that there is some element of contrast, so that they are seen as being different, albeit that maybe a slight different use of colour, a frame on the other side, etc. If two items are really not the same, make them significantly different. Otherwise, you have confusion. And if you're going to use a contrast, make it strong. So, why are visuals and graphics important in a report? Now, we've been talking particularly about the presentation of written documents, in particular business reports. They're very important because what they do is that they make points vivid, and they help the readers see, in inverted commas, the data. They enable readers to engage with the text or the oral presentation using another sense, allowing them to see what you are talking about. It adds another dimension, if you like. And remember I said, by adding an extra sensory dimension, engages attention, interpretation, and therefore potentially memory. They should supplement or enhance a text or an oral presentation, however, not replace it. So on a screen, for example, you should have keywords rather than every word that you're going to say. Visuals allow information to be presented more compactly than words. They can convey or simplify complex data, and we'll have some examples of these later on. Demonstrate contrasts and comparisons, suggest movements or trends over time, and emphasise the physical appearance of something, which is much more difficult to do when you are using language. They can analyse concepts, processes, and abstract relationships. However, as I've said, they should not aim to replace the text, but merely to supplement the text. And there are certain characteristics and others that apply specifically to a graphic device in question. Okay, when they're used within a report, or within a report, they shouldn't be just there in isolation, allowing the reader to, you know, just there for the reader to interpret as they will. They need to be referenced, they need to be located, they need to have a label, and they need to have a title. So basically what I'm saying is that it's up to the writer of the report or the presenter to put their interpretation on it. So when the reader comes to it, they know why it is there. They should know what basically what the reader thinks it should mean. Now, it may well be that the reader doesn't think it means that at all, but that's their prerogative. So to incorporate it, for example, if you have a chart or a diagram, give it a title and refer to it, as shown in Figure 1. Table 3 illustrates that, etc. Now, different graphics, not all graphics are the same, and they serve different purposes. So one of the most important things is for the writer to choose the appropriate visual for the story, for the style, for the audience, and for the data that they are representing. And of course, from an ethical point of view, each visual must be accurate and it must be ethical. Okay, so what are the certain conventions? What are the conventions that that we need to be aware of? Okay, so identify an analytic perspective for the data. Give it an interpretative title. I'll give you some illustrations of these in a moment. Clearly identify or describe the type of data. You know, are you surveying, so are you representing raw data, or are you projecting? Are you working out what might happen if a particular trend continues? If you, you should always, when you have graphs or charts or whatever, label the units. So if you have a pie chart, for example, each of the slices in a pie needs to be labelled, because sometimes they're not necessarily always drawn exactly, or it's not easy to interpret what percentage that represents or what that slice actually represents. When you have line graphs, for example, or histograms, you must label the axes. Again, what do those measurements represent? If you're going to use different colours or different design schemes for, you know, for the bars or for the line, use a legend. What do they represent? Okay, it makes it easier to read. If you take the graphic from somewhere, if you've taken it off the internet, if you've used it out of a book, you must list where it comes from. So just as you cite a resource or paraphrase someone's idea in your report or in your essay, you must do the same in a visual, even if it comes from a website, in using the same conventions. And as I said before, you need to integrate them and discuss them in the text. Label them, you know, table 1, figure 1, etc., etc. Okay, so what are some of the good and the bad points with graphics? What sort of things can go wrong? Okay, now the next few slides illustrate some of these. All right, so let's have a look at this. What's wrong with this particular graphic? Okay, have a look at it. Now, the question could be, has there been a growth in the number of bananas between 1960 and 1980? Or have the bananas grown, increased in size? And obviously, that's fairly ambiguous. I would say it's the number of bananas, but it's not really very clear as to what that is supposed to mean. Okay. All right, there's a range of different types of graphical devices. All right. So line graphs, for example. Now, the good thing about line graphs is that they indicate movements over time, they compare frequency, they identify correlations. However, and as you can see with this particular one, inappropriate labels or scales can make them very difficult to interpret. So the question is, what's the difference between these two graphs? Essentially nothing. What's different is the scale. So if we're looking at this, the graph on slide 14, one is, one looks very positive, one looks negative. Now, essentially, it's a visual illusion because there isn't anything different other than the scale. So it's a rather unethical sort of graph. Okay. In line graphs, if you are talking about time, okay, time should go on the horizontal axis. If you're going to have a range of lines, avoid more than three or four. And you'll notice in this particular one, you know, we've got a legend there. Use different colours and the legend. Label the axes. Label the graph. Avoid perspective. Avoid sort of 3D types of things because they can be quite difficult to interpret. So on slide 16, for example, you know, it looks nice, looks very pretty, but in actual fact, you know, rather difficult to actually interpret. Okay. All right, column or bar graphs, again, very, very commonly used. They're used to compare items, to show distributions, to highlight correlations. They can be different types of bar graphs, can be used for different purposes. All right, so they can be grouped, which is they compare aspects of the same item across time. And I'll give you some examples of these in a moment. They can be segmented, divided, subdivided, stacked, help compare totals but can't compare segments. They can be used to identify opposites, to show deviation or to show correlation. Now, one of the problems with them is it's difficult for the eye sometimes to interpret the size and the proportion. So the labelling, again, has to be fairly good. But you'll notice with this particular one from Yunsen, it has a title, okay, figure 5.16, all right. Again, it's representing, you know, gizmo sales. Okay. Example of grouped bar charts. Allow comparisons, all right? Labels, you know, the bars that are, you know, being compared are grouped and they are visually separate, all right? Segmented, subdivided bar charts show different relationships, all right? Again, you notice the difference in the use of colours. Deviations show exceptions, all right? So you see the bit that's above the line and the bit that's below the line. Okay. Now, when you are designing bar charts, all right, make sure that you use a logical order. So it does depend upon what the bar chart is actually designing, all right? So is it chronological? Is it by region? Is it by, you know, similarities? Okay, year, for example. Make sure that the bars are close enough for comparison. As I said, label both the axes and make the increments consistent. So if you're going to be measuring them, they should be measured by equal, vertical axis should be by equal amounts. Make the bars the same width. Use colours for coding, not just to look good. And avoid what's referred to as chart junk. So if you look at slide 22, all right, it looks pretty good, but, you know, there's a lot of superfluous visual information in there that really detracts from what the chart is trying to show. Okay. Now, pie charts are very, very popular, used quite significantly to show relative proportions and the importance of each part to the whole. Again, one of the major rules is to label the segments and the proportions outside the pie. Now, in this particular one, visually, it's probably difficult to see that, for example, or to work out that manufacturing represents 35.54% of that whole. All right. I mean, we can get a bit of a visual idea, but if we want it to be exact, it needs to be labelled. Don't have too many segments. 5 to 7 roughly is the rule, and it can be difficult if you're trying to be be accurate, probably a pie chart is not the best choice, as it can be difficult to judge area and differences. Okay, so if you want to be absolutely accurate, you should choose some other form of graphical device. Okay, this one is a relatively good example on slide 24. All right, okay. All right, this one's a poor example because the perspective makes it difficult to understand, or more difficult to understand. Tables, very, very commonly used in scientific reports, in business reports, etc. Very important, allow comprehensive detail, allow a lot of data to be set out. If you try to write all of that into your report, your reader would lose interest and not be able to follow you at all. It makes the reader focus on the data, not on your interpretation of it. So one of the major advantages is that you can present the raw data. As a writer, you can interpret it. As a reader, can also perhaps challenge that interpretation. But we need to remember that how the table is set out can affect the interpretation, as I'll show you in a moment. One of the downsides of tables is that they are difficult to read quickly. They're there, so if you're going to put them up, for example, on a PowerPoint slide, you may need to choose a different kind of a device. They're probably better in a written report where people have the time to sit and study what the table is doing. Okay. And the other thing that's hard to recognise is the relationship sometimes between things. Now, if we look at these two tables, it's the same information presented differently, but in both of them we could actually choose to interpret them differently, basically by saying, well, okay, what is the focus of the top one compared to the bottom one? Because we tend to read left to right, the focus perhaps is on the seasons, whereas in the bottom one it's more on the cities, the American cities. So how it's presented, the way that you structure the information, you need to consider that when you are actually drawing your tables. Okay, so let's just have a summary of these sorts of things. Okay. Use charts to simplify data, pick an appropriate style, bar charts most common for business audiences. Make sure you have an interpretative title. You want your readers to understand in a way the data in a way that supports your arguments, not theirs. So make sure your title represents or communicates how you interpret that data, and avoid chart junk. Okay. Now, of course, diagrams are very, very commonly used, particularly in instructions, for example, particularly in technical documents. All right. So, if you're going to include diagrams in a business report, make sure that the important thing about them is that they allow the emphasis to be placed on the details of interest. And generally by representing the process or representing the machine or whatever in a simple way. Now, because it's two-dimensional, they can also show a cross-section and allow views that are not available in photos. All right. And in having a diagram, you can actually focus on the elements that are chosen to be, rather than the superfluous detail that might be more present. More likely to be present in a photo. However, if you try to put too much in, if you try to make it too much a reflection of reality, the diagram can become very cluttered. Now, you notice in this particular one of the important things is that the elements are labelled, so the petrol bowser, the underground tank, and that, again, it has a title and it has a label. Photographs are, again, incredibly important, but not necessarily, the most appropriate, but in certain cases, probably the best forms of representation. All right, they show a subject as it appears. It has an immediate impact. We've talked about the importance of the visual in our culture. Photographs and photographic representations create the perception of authenticity. Now, I say perception because it isn't always authentic. We know these days, particularly with photo manipulation programs like Photoshop, that what you see isn't necessarily always what you get. The thing with photographs is that it can be difficult to see the point because of detail, so that may need to be cropped so that the key point is not lost. Of course, they can be easily manipulated or set up, and we do need to remember that, particularly when photos are used in magazines and newspapers and things like that, and they can be misinterpreted when taken out of context. So does the camera ever lie? Yes? Or no? All right, one's a real photo, one's not. I'll let you guess which one. Okay. Of course, they can be humorous, or they can be serious. Or, of course, some have a major problem and can be the major potential for world conflict. So these are ones that were taken in relation to the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Okay. Now, cartoons are, in my view, always fun. Again, they tend to focus very much on a theme. They tend to allow us in a good cartoon, in a very succinct and pithy way, you know, look at a broad theme. So, of course, Gary Larson, who anyone who's listened to my lectures or seen my slides will know that I'm very fond of The Far Side and Gary Larson. Because of the humorous theme. So, of course, in that particular one is Larson, another Larson one. Okay. Or they can be very serious. Okay. These are ones that were anti-war ones. And one of the interesting things about political cartoons especially is that they're very, very powerful. They're very powerful forms of propaganda and of social commentary. Okay, so when choosing appropriate illustrations, we must also keep in mind that they are representational and that the context in which they are used impacts on the meaning. Hence the choice of young, blonde, thin, white people as the archetypal images in much of advertising is not accidental. It's chosen. Those particular images, those particular ways of representing things that are desirable and, you know, positive notions are very much, it's very much a conscious choice. If we think about layout, for example, in your assignments, in your slides that you may do, you know, for presentations, in your reports, in any kind of document, we have to remember that layout is the non-verbal aspect of written communication. Graphics, for example, the word graphic comes from the Greek graphikos, meaning drawing or writing. So therefore, a graphic can also refer to the way that words are set out on a page. As writing, we need to be aware of how our text looks as well as what it says. And while this isn't really the place to go into the detail of these sorts of things, and, you know, we're not necessarily doing desktop publishing, here are a few kinds of hints, for example, that might help make your report look professional. Okay. All right. So layout is the non-verbal aspect of communication. And we need to remember that things like our headings and our subheadings and numbering act as visual signposts to guide your reader through the text, to help your reader read more efficiently
help you read, make it easier. It's a little bit like cutting up your food on the plate by arranging it nicely rather than putting it all in a blender.
Body text for reading, the conventions are that it should be between 10 and 12 point. Now, the default in most programs like Word is 12 point. Can be smaller on the net. Anything too large, again, takes away from the seriousness of what you're doing. Headings, of course, can be larger. Now, in a report or in an essay, try and use the same typeface, type size and leading, which is line spacing, for all of your body copy. Make sure that you have enough space between your lines to make the text easy to read. All right. Make your paragraph beginnings clear. Traditionally, paragraph indentation was used to indicate the beginning of a paragraph in the old days when things were typed. These days, left alignment is more normal with space between the paragraphs. In newspapers, they still use paragraph indentation mainly because they are limited in space. A ragged right margin rather than a justified margin makes the text more visually interesting. It makes it easier to read. Now remember that reading is a mental skill. You need to aid your readers wherever possible. Leave more space above headlines and subheads than below them, and use subheads liberally to help the readers find what they're looking for. But again, the words that you use should be descriptive. It should describe what the sections are about. And white space used skillfully can be used to show readers where to start and where to stop. It can isolate important messages. If you use if you choose a design device, make sure that you use it throughout the document. So, for example, if you're going to have your headings all in, Arial 14 point bold, make sure that all of your major headings are Arial 14 point bold. Don't chop and change. Okay. Now, some of these examples of, establishing recognisable patterns might include the signals used, so whether you use arrows or you use numbers. So, again, don't mix and match. Have a pattern and stick to it. The words or the terms used for captions, the format of questions or headings. So if you have your headings as a question, make sure that all your headings are as a question, etc. If you're going to use screen backgrounds, maybe to highlight sort of little text boxes or whatever, use the same pattern throughout, and the same typeface and type size used for text, headings and captions. Remember the rules of line spacing. Text is difficult when the lines are positioned too close together, and too much space between them makes the thought seem disconnected. All right, so remember the notion of proximity and contrast, etc. Text is most legible when the line separation is about 1.5 times the letter height. Now, in some programs you can actually manually do this, in others you just go with the default and you may need to actually go ahead and change it. And did you know that of the people who pick up a newsletter, 100% will read the headlines, the kickers and the photo captions, 70% will read subheads, underlined items, bullets, bold-faced items, quotes, illustration captions, but only 5 to 30% will read text. Therefore, the aim should be, in terms of design and layout, should be to make the text more palatable, make the text easier to read, make the text more obvious. Not necessarily dumb it down, but visually encourage, make it more inviting, and you do that with the design elements. All right. We have a raft of different fonts available to us. But again, fonts and typefaces have a message. All right, you can have a look at those ones. Limit yourself to three different type settings. And pick a font in terms of its size, its style, its character,
which is consistent with the audience or the type of message that you're sending. Okay. Avoid all caps as this slows reading, and the same for justified text. All right, some examples in terms of, all right, size, colour, certain choice of typeface, underlining, red text can be quite hard to read. All right, if it's all caps, does it help? Okay, and the difference between serif and sans serif. Now again, they have a different character, and it does depend upon what the document is about. All right. Okay. In certain instances, the size of the type will vary according to what you're going to be using it for. If, for example, you're using it in a PowerPoint presentation, you want people at the back of the room to be able to see it. So, you know, 35 to 40 is a good size because people from a distance can read it. In a document which is being read individually, 12 point is the appropriate size. Don't cut, and if you're going to be using an overhead, for example, don't copy or photocopy and then copy onto an overhead the text of a report, because the text will be too cluttered and too small for people to read in a presentation format. Okay. Remember that different typefaces have inherent meaning. So choose one that suits the style and the audience of your message. So have a look at some of these. All right. So think about the character that these are, you know, perhaps illustrating. All right, and of course, with incorrect word spacing or letter spacing, which is called kerning, the consequences can be disastrous. Okay, finally, for those of you who are fans of the old Burjo's catchphrase, I've got an IQ tip, and this is just for fun. The idea is that if you look at these, can you work out what the word is? So it's a combination of letters and visuals and spacing and all those things that we've talked about. Okay.